The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for the last few times that I've been here, we've been exploring the Eightfold Path, exploring this part of the Buddhist teaching where he basically offers us kind of a map. I think of the Eightfold Path as a little bit of a map and some directions. And the first two aspects of the path, wise view and wise intention, are kind of the direction aspect, the piece of here's where you want to be going. And the rest of the Eightfold Path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration, are kind of like how you want to walk on that map, how you want to take the journey. And this journey is really defined by the perspective that the Buddha brought to his own journey, which was a curiosity of, is it possible to be free from suffering? Is it possible as a human being to be free from suffering? Now that question, on the face of it, it sounds like it would be impossible, because we know as human beings we experience pain, we experience things in the world happen that we have little control over. And so there, the suffering that the Buddha talked about possibly being free from isn't the kind of being free from all unpleasant experience, being free from the unpleasantness that other people engage in, being free from unpleasantness of body, of physicality. That is not what the Buddha found, that it was possible to be free of that. But he did find that it is possible that given the conditions of the world, whatever's happening in our bodies, our minds, in the world at large, it is possible to find a heart that is at ease, at peace, that is non-reactive to what is happening, that is not resisting, fighting with greed, aversion, confusion, what is happening in the world. So non-reactive, what we might think of as a peaceful heart or a non-reactive heart, again, the English words might convey a sense that, well, if we're non-reactive to what's happening in the world, then we wouldn't be acting in the world. And again, that's a misunderstanding of what the peace of heart that the Buddha found is. That he discovered this possibility of a heart that is not constricted around what's happening, a heart that's not pushing and pulling around what's happening, a heart that's not confused around what's happening. But that heart that is not confused, not restrictive, not constricted, not pushing and pulling, is not simply sitting here. The heart that is meeting the world, the unconstricted heart that meets the world, is a very active heart and creates the wish to engage in being in this world to two sides, potentially. To one side, to not contribute to the suffering in the world, and the other, to actively support or engage in ways to reduce suffering in the world. And so this was the Buddhist journey, and wise view and wise intention kind of speak to this being the direction of what the Buddha taught. And so the wisdom of wise view is, and we could we could think about wisdom meaning something very large and like the entire wisdom of the universe. But the Buddha pointed to a very specific kind of wisdom around how does this suffering that creates the constricted heart, how does that come to be and how can it be released? What are the ways that we can engage in our own experience, in our own practices? And what are the ways that we can engage in relationship with others to lessen the suffering in the world? And again, this movement to lessen the suffering in the world, from our habitual perspective, we might think that that movement would naturally, or would the only way that movement would come from, would be from a place of reactivity, from a place of aversion to what's happening in the world. It's so hard for us from a perspective of habitually having met the world with a push-pull to think there's any other way to meet the world. And yet this heart that is unconstricted, this unconstricted heart, is very engaged and wishes to act in the world from a place of compassion, from a place of love, from a place of generosity, from a place of kindness and connection and care for ourselves and for others. It acts from those intentions to explore alleviating the suffering of the world, of acting in the world to change the world. And so this Eightfold Path kind of lays out the steps or the practices or the tools for our journey, for our engagement. Some of those tools are directly related to engaging with our fellow human beings, engaging in relationship. And some of those tools are more used in terms of looking at our relationship to ourselves. And so I think of the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, as being kind of the roadmap or the set of tools for engaging in our relationships with each other. And the tools of wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration support those activities. The wise effort, wise mindfulness, wise concentration are needed as we engage with each other. But those tools also support us looking inward, at looking inward to our own relationship to ourselves. And what's happening in here that's contributing to my struggles and my suffering? What's happening inside that there might be a different relationship, a different possibility, a different way to engage in. But tonight I'd like to mostly focus on this aspect of relationship with the world, the connection with our fellow human beings. You know, when we think about meditation, we often think about sitting in silence with our eyes closed and not so much in engagement with each other. But the Eightfold Path, three aspects of the Eightfold Path are clearly about engagement. How do we meet the world? How do we connect to each other? How do we have cultures and societies and relationships that both do not contribute to suffering and actually actively support us in community to move away from suffering? And so these three, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, really it's kind of a description of the ethical view the Buddha had. The ethical view of what would be a useful way to live in the world. In bringing up this word ethics, sometimes the word is virtue or morality. We can have a relationship with that word at times that may be based on our upbringing or our relationship to other ethical teachings, other teachings on morality. For me, in my upbringing, in the Christian tradition, the Judeo-Christian tradition, morality seemed to be expressed as, thou shalt not. And so it really felt kind of like I'm being told, what I shouldn't do, mostly what I shouldn't do. And so the relationship to ethics was a lot about feeling like, well, I shouldn't be doing things. Feeling like actions are restricted. And the motivation behind that, to me, it was like, well, this is what a good person does. That was kind of the reason. A good person won't do these things. That was the reason that was given. And I, wanting to be a good person, I certainly wanted to do those things. And yet what I felt a little bit was lacking, that I feel like I have found in this Buddhist understanding of ethics, is a kind of more of a motivation, or more of an investigation or a discovery of ethics internally. What does my heart say about engaging in relationship? And this, I think, is a key shift for me around Buddhist ethics, that what I felt about the ethics of my religion from my childhood was that the ethics was imposed from without. It was like, this is what you're told to do, rather than being something that I discovered from within, rather than being a kind of a natural expression from inside. And so in the Buddhist understanding, the question of ethics, I think of it as really, it's pragmatic in terms of if we want to step onto this path, this direction of exploring, how can I be free from suffering? How can I participate in a community that wants to move in that direction? Then what the Buddha pointed to is that there are certain actions that are worth looking at in terms of how they might affect the world. And in fact, the ethical statements in the Buddhist tradition they seem very similar on the surface of it to those of the Ten Commandments. They're refraining from killing, refraining from taking what's not given, refraining from creating harm through sexuality, refraining from false speech. And so on the surface of it, they do seem very similar. And yet the motivation isn't do this because I told you to, but the motivation is very much that the Buddha points us. He says, if you want to free your heart from suffering, these actions, if engaged in, would contribute to suffering in the world and in your own heart. And so we can start to explore that. We can start to recognize that when we as human beings engage in certain ways, engage in ways that create harm. Really, I think of ethics, a lot of about ethics in the Buddhist tradition is about exploring non-harming, exploring this question of how can I act in the world that will not add harm to the world? Not adding harm to myself, not adding harm to others. And again, because if we are interested in looking at this question of suffering, and looking at this question of how does suffering come to be, then it's really useful to engage in or not engage in actions that would add suffering, that would cause suffering in the world. And yet for me, it really started to come alive, this question of ethics, when I began exploring and understanding with some of the other factors of the Eightfold Path, with mindfulness and with effort, to look at this question of ethics and the question of why engage in refraining from these actions. Why do that? Because our hearts actually give us some feedback. When we are aware of what's happening in our hearts as we are thinking about what we're going to do, our hearts give us some feedback. There are two qualities that the Buddha pointed to around this ethical dimension, two qualities of heart. He sometimes called them the guardians of the world. And they are, in the Pali, they are called Hiri and Otapa. And I like the translation that Thanissaro Bhikkhu offers for these two. Hiri, he translates as conscience, and Otapa, he translates as concern. So these are heart qualities. I've felt them as heart qualities. And basically, what happens in the heart, as we think back on what has happened to us in the past, if we have done something that has caused harm in the past, the heart that is undefended, that is open, will feel a kind of a quivering. It'll feel something. When we, reflecting back on our past, when we recognize, yes, that was something that created harm, we feel it. This quality of hiri, of conscience, when we do not have an open heart, when we are constricted in the heart, we will feel that we've done something wrong, but because our heart is tight, that quality kind of lands often and gets tied up in knots, and it might be experienced as guilt, it might be experienced as shame, it might be experienced as a pushing away of separating. Well, that person just deserved that anyway. You know, all kinds of machinations we can get up to in our minds when we look back at having created harm. And if our heart is not open and receptive and willing to feel that quivering of conscience, it may contract and slide into shame or guilt. And yet this it's important to begin to explore this when we reflect back and have done something that caused harm, to recognize with mindfulness, okay, yes, it actually hurts to have done something that created harm. Even when the heart is undefended, it will feel that. It's like the heart, when it's undefended, when it remembers pain and suffering that it's caused, it resonates, it quivers in sympathy with that pain. To me, this is a feature of our hearts. This is a beautiful thing of our hearts, that we are designed to feel the suffering of other beings. We are designed to empathize and resonate with that. When we think back and realize that we've participated in that, if we think back and remember some harm that we've caused or created or participated in, and we feel that, that movement of heart is kind of designed to help us to not do that in the future. It's designed to help us, to support us. And yet so often we feel like we get tight around it, we clamp down around it, and we feel like, oh, anything. I don't want to feel this way. I it's got to be something else. We push it away, or we wallow in it, or we sink into it, one or the other. And so our hearts are designed to have this resonant quality on reflection back. And likewise, on reflecting into the future, thinking into the future, our hearts are designed to have this resonant quality. If we think about something that we might do, this is otapa, this is the concern. Our concern for our fellow human beings can be reflected as we think about what things we might do. As we, our minds, again, are designed to kind of model, imagine in a way, what might happen if we do something. So if we reflect before we do something, we might see, we might know, oh, that might hurt somebody. And again, the kind of quivering or the sense of the heart that knows that, that feels a little off. Maybe I don't want to do that. And so again, these qualities of hiri and otapa are kind of designed to support us in not adding harm to the world. I think this is a beautiful aspect of our hearts. And when I began to be curious about these qualities and not feel defensive, and not feel tied or kind of, you know, holding on to, well, this is what I want to do, but willing to explore the consequences through this undefended heart, then I got much more curious and interested in ethics as an inner discovery. And these qualities, when we are mindful, when we are open to attending to our heart in relationship, as we reflect on our relationships in the past, as we reflect on our relationships now, as we reflect on our relationships, thinking about how we might relate in the future, our heart is giving us guidance, is pointing us. It's like we have a moral compass in there, an ethical compass that helps us to recognize, ooh, that way is the skillful way. And we get this kind of feedback when what we are contemplating doing or what we have done, we get feedback when it has been harmful. And so this has been something for me that this is the encouragement of the Buddhist tradition to be curious about our actions, to be curious about how they affect others and ourselves. Using mindfulness to be curious about what happens. And when we explore that, when we open to what's here in our hearts, our hearts give us really good direction, partly based on these qualities of conscience and concern. And so we do have this inner, I think we're designed almost with an inner ethics. And these guidelines, I think the guidelines of most of the great religious traditions are in alignment with this inner compass, with this inner ethical sense that we have. And yet for me, until I began really feeling into that and noticing, recognizing, wow, it's beneficial to not do that, not just because somebody told me to, but because of basically how this being is put together, because of how we are as human beings. So the Buddha gave this kind of advice to his 7-year-old son, essentially, to explore ethical, this question of ethics on his own. I think it's really it's really interesting. This is basically the first teaching the Buddha gave his own son. It was a teaching on ethics. But he didn't use that word in the teaching, as far as I know. I don't believe he used the word sila, the Pali word. He just basically encouraged Rahula to reflect on his actions. Reflect. Reflect before you act. Is this going to create affliction for yourself or another, or for both? And so very much what I was talking about, we've got this capacity to reflect, to think about what's going to happen, and we can know. We can kind of, the modeling aspect of our minds can kind of recognize, well, this is maybe what's going to unfold. And so we can reflect before we act. What is this going to, how is this going to affect ourselves or others? And the Buddha said to his son, well, if you see it's going to cause affliction, pain, oppression, harm to yourself or another, he said, don't do that. And so he very much aligns this teaching on ethics with suffering. Is this action going to create suffering, either for yourself or another? Don't do it if you see that it's going to. And then he encourages him to continue. Reflect while you are acting. Is it causing suffering to yourself or another, or both? If so, stop. If not, then continue. And again, it's kind of a little bit of a tying of the teaching on intention with the teaching on ethics here. Because in reflecting in advance, we are looking at, well, what do I intend to do? So what's my intention? And in reflecting on our intention, we can see, you know, some of the ways we can see that harm might be caused is by seeing what our inner kind of motivation for doing something is. You know, if our inner motivation behind saying something has a skew of anger to it, there's a great likelihood that what's going to come out is going to be harmful. And so the looking at how we're going to act before we act is kind of connecting to that intention, connecting to what is the intention that we want to act from, and encouraging us to explore that intention. And now in terms of seeing, when we look with mindfulness at that experience, if we see that there's an intention of anger or greed or fear or confusion, we can see, actually, with mindfulness, that experience itself, that anger, that greed, that confusion, that fear, is already afflicting us. And so we are already experiencing affliction in that. And the Buddha encouraged us, well, then that's probably not a good place to start from. If where we are starting from in our action is already afflicting us, not a good place to start. And so while we were acting, this a similar kind of reflection. Is this creating harm? If so, then stop. But if not, then continue. And likewise, reflecting after you have acted. So again, you know, so I talked at the beginning, reflecting back on the past, reflecting into the future. Reflecting back on the past, the Buddha encouraged us to look at, encouraged his son to, did this cause harm? Did it create suffering? If it did, he said, undertake restraint in the future. Now this one I really think bears some looking at. Actually, the entirety of the teaching, I think, is really worth exploring. Because first of all, the Buddha is encouraging us to reflect the teaching of the Buddha is not simply about be present in the present moment. He's encouraging us to use our minds, to use our thoughts, to use our understanding of past and future, to recognize these things happened in the past. What can I learn from them? These things might happen in the future. Is that a good direction? And so he's encouraging reflection. Really, I think this entire sutta, the emphasis of this entire sutta is about reflection, using our reflective capacity to think about how we are engaged in relationship. And so not only is it using our thoughts, but it's also using our thoughts in relationship to how we are with each other. This is not what we usually think of as our practice when we sit down quietly and watch our breathing, but an active engagement with how we are with each other and thinking about it. And so using reflection and being present, this is a place where I feel like the mindfulness and the reflection join. There's a way that we can reflect on the past, the future, and be present for how we are in that reflection. This is where the learning comes from. This is where we can be available to recognize those qualities of conscience and concern. We can be available to recognize when the heart is feeling ease and peace and joy and generosity and connection versus constriction and confusion and anger. And so as we're reflecting, it's not just about the thoughts, it's about, ooh, how are those thoughts affecting me? How does it feel to think about the past? When I reflect on the past, was there suffering created? If so, the Buddha says to undertake restraint in the future. But the other thing I think that's useful here is to reflect, because if we've been following the guidelines of this reflection all the way through, before, during, then we've taken steps into acting and thought it was not going to create suffering, not going to add harm to the world. And yet, sometimes we can act out of really good intention, and yet harm does happen. And so how do we work with that? How do we explore that side of things? To me, this reflection adds something to the puzzle there, adds something to what we can explore, reflecting back on what happened. Because if suffering has been created, I mean, the first movement or the first kind of part of the mind might be, well, my intention was good, so must be their karma, their fault, their problem, their issue. It's not anything about me, because my intentions were good. So we kind of let ourselves off the hook. And yet what I think is being pointed to here, I think there's something more that is being pointed to here, not just letting ourselves off the hook, but being curious. Curious about, what did I not understand? What did I not know? This takes a lot of courage. It takes courage to recognize, wow, that action created suffering. Is there something that I was unaware of, either in my own mind or in the situation, that I need to learn from? So this I think is really pointing to learning from our mistakes, and also learning from our non-mistakes. I mean, in this case, that, you know, if you've been checking in, it's like before, during, the intention seems good, no sense of there being an issue or a problem, and yet suffering happens, harm is caused. What did I not understand? And it takes courage to look at that, to let your heart be fully open And be curious about that, especially if you see that something that you've done has directly contributed to harm. There's an experience I had a couple of years ago where I did something. I had a conversation with somebody. Somebody came to me and wanted some support, and I communicated something to somebody else. And to me, it felt like I was doing something wholesome. And yet, the fallout or the repercussion, the kind of the what followed from that was so much suffering for so many people. And I could see that my intention was to support and to help. And yet, there were some things that I did not know. And in this case, there's a whole set of things that I didn't know. And I spent a lot of time reflecting on, you know, what I could have done differently, or how do I learn from this? And I did. I learned quite a bit. And there was a lot of that heery going on in the heart while I was doing this. A lot of that feeling of, oh, wow, that action, boy, that created so much suffering. It hurts. It is very painful. It hurts. We don't often think of wholesome qualities of heart as being painful, but these qualities can have that sense of hurting. But when the heart is not tight or defended, that quality, it's such an interesting thing that a couple years ago when I was going through this, I could feel the heart kind of shifting between being open and recognizing, wow, there's a lot to learn here. Whew, wow, it hurts to have done that. Hurts to have been a participant in that amount of suffering. And then the heart like going, not my fault. Now, I didn't know those things. Not my fault. And that was even more painful, actually, when I could feel that. The feeling of, you know, separation. And then there was another side that was, so there was that side of the hiri, that the heart shifted from that kind of just like the willingness to be in the field of, ooh, it feels like this to have created suffering. It feels like this to have been a participant in that. The kind of like, whoop, not my fault. That's one movement. The other was the slide into shame. Really my fault. I did such a bad thing. I am such a bad person. Really kind of almost wallowing in that. And it's just like there's such a fine line there with these feelings in the heart to shift between those. And what I felt and found in that moment was that there's such a habit. We have such a habit when we feel those feelings in the heart, such a habit of moving to one of those two. Of moving either to the not my fault or the feeling of shame. And so it takes a lot of courage to sit in the middle with that undefended heart and hold that and be willing to learn from it. So it's quite a practice. It's quite a practice. And yet, that's how we learn. That is how we learn. And so, not only to learn those things, but also to learn how to meet others, to make amends when appropriate. It's not always appropriate, not always even possible. Sometimes something has happened in the past when somebody who has been close to us dies. Sometimes we may do a kind of a review with that person and feel like, wow, that created some suffering, or there was some things that I did that I wish I hadn't done with that person. There's no way to make amends at that point. And so sometimes we can't quite make amends. And sometimes making amends, it's also really useful if we're thinking about making amends to look at who are we making amends for? Am I doing it so that I can absolve myself? Are we doing it so that I can feel like, okay, I don't have to feel that anymore? Is that why we are making amends, to kind of get ourselves off the hook? Or is it to genuinely reconnect with the person? That to me is what the amends is about, is reestablishing connection, reestablishing relationship. And so looking at that side of it, looking at how to make amends, and this also, I think, takes a deep inquiry. That there's not just one way. It really is very dynamic depending on the person, the situation, whether it's a group of people or an individual, depending on how you participated in the situation. There's so many different conditions that come into how making amends might happen. And then another piece of it is asking for forgiveness and forgiving ourselves. These are important pieces to explore also. And in this, there are different pieces for myself in that situation I described. The self-forgiveness came first, that I recognized, yeah, there was a lot I didn't know. I can recognize that my actions created suffering, and there was a lot that I didn't know. And so that I could forgive myself. And then in terms of making amends with others, I did ask for forgiveness. That different people have different perspectives on this, but to me, I mean, I understand in asking for forgiveness that the other person or people may or may not be able to forgive. And yet there's something about that process. It's acknowledging. It is really acknowledging that this action created direct harm. It's acknowledging that to the other person, and acknowledging that the to me, the request for forgiveness is an act of humility, essentially. It's an act of humility that points to the recognition in relationship that I see this created harm. I see that this was not a good thing to have done. And so there's also a forgiveness practice that we can explore. At times, as I mentioned, we can't necessarily make amends directly with people, but we can work with forgiveness internally. Jack Kornfield offers this in one of his books. I think it's got forgiveness in the title, where he encourages us to reflect on situations. So it's a reflective practice, bringing into mind situations and in three stages, looking at ways in which I have harmed others and asking for forgiveness. In any way that I have harmed you, I ask for your forgiveness. That's an internal process that we can do, that we can envision the other person, envision the situation, and make that almost as a resolve or as an inner request. And so it can do something internally in our own hearts to do that if we don't have the opportunity or the possibility to do it directly with the other person. The second part of the forgiveness practice is forgiving those who have harmed us. And the language that Jack uses is, for anything that I have done intentionally or unintentionally that has created suffering or harm, in any way that I've harmed you, intentionally or unintentionally, I ask for your forgiveness. In any way that you have harmed me, intentionally or unintentionally, I forgive you. This one, depending on the situation, we may or may not be ready to forgive. And so Jack offers an option there, which is something along the lines of, I wish that I may forgive you someday, kind of pointing the heart in that direction of forgiving the other person someday if we can't forgive them now. Forgiveness is not about saying it was okay for somebody to have done something. When we forgive somebody for having done something, it is more that we are acknowledging, yeah, I see in my own heart, I do things out of confusion, out of not understanding, out of not knowing things that might have been known, and I can create harm. So too others can do this same thing. And so it's not saying that the action was forgivable. Some actions may not be forgivable. But the person is what we are connecting with. It is the forgiveness is about reestablishing a heart connection, even if not an actual in-the-world relationship. There may be some people who have done things to us that we cannot, and it's not a good idea to engage in a real, active, real-world relationship with them. But we can have our heart be not closed to them. And so the forgiveness can be a challenging practice for us in this way, the recognition of forgiving the person for their confusion, forgiving the person for their ignorance, for their not knowing, for their unawareness. That's kind of the way I think about that forgiveness. And then the third aspect of the forgiveness is forgiving ourselves for any ways in which I have harmed myself. I forgive myself for any ways that I've harmed myself intentionally or unintentionally. I forgive myself. This forgiveness, this inner forgiveness for me was one of those pieces that supported the heart to stay in the open place around that quivering of having caused harm. That there were things I didn't understand. And can my heart stay open to myself around this? Can I forgive myself for being ignorant? Can I forgive myself for that? That piece partly is what helped the heart to stay open. It was when I could not forgive myself that I would slip into the shame or move into that, not my fault. So this exploration around ethics, to me, it's such an important piece of our lives. How we choose to engage with each other, how we choose to meet our families, our friends, our communities. Exploring with an open heart. This the teaching that the Buddha offered his son is. To me, what he was pointing to was this exploration of the heart. Can you touch into that inner compass, that inner ethical guide, and discover ethics inside? Can we discover our own inner ethics? That's probably enough. Are there any comments or questions?
Hello. One question
I don't think it's on.
One question I have is concerning, so a lot of tonight's talk, concerned kind of reflecting and, kind of comprehending what one has done in this context. And I guess I'm curious, how does one differentiate that from something like kind of depressive rumination or something that's kind of ongoing and not really helpful and kind of just a lot of cognitions around these kinds of things?
About, how do we distinguish this kind of reflection from depressive rumination? And I think a lot of it does have to do with our sense of being present. When we're in a depressive rumination, often we're caught. We're not so mindful. We are just, kind of sunk. If we are mindful, if we are aware, and we notice that we're sunk, there's a distinct feeling to being caught. It kind of feels like we're wrapped or just like circling and not getting anywhere. It's like a whirlpool or an eddy or something like that. It's just, so there's a feeling to that depressive rumination. If we are mindful, there's a feeling to it. If we're not mindful, we're probably caught in it. And so, it's really helpful to explore this kind of reflection. One teacher suggested doing this consciously, picking a time during the day where you actually choose to reflect. And this teacher, Annie Nugent, said, make yourself a hot bath, get yourself really relaxed. I don't know in California if a hot bath is such a good idea, but, let yourself really be relaxed. Set yourself up, not to start thinking about it immediately, but let yourself really just relax, take some time to settle, and then start reflecting. And so relax, and then review, begin reviewing, and then reflecting on how does that feel? And seeing if you can, in the reflection, keep a sense of the heart. And even at a very general level, like, ooh, does the heart feel constricted or open? And if it feels open, how is that landing? Does it feel like quivery or at ease? So we can know that difference. I think inside we will know that difference between that kind of being wrapped in a whirlpool. And it can happen, even if we start a reflection consciously, that we can be kind of heading along, and yep, okay, there's that, and yep, and then get wrapped into a whirlpool. And so even going into it with some kind of care, we might find that we get caught. And if that happens, it can be useful to, okay, ooh, I'm caught. Okay, so this is not the time to keep thinking about that. Maybe I should just feel what it's like to feel caught. Maybe I should just change the channel if I'm feeling like I'm getting sucked into it. Actually turn my attention to something else. Because when we are pulled into something like that, sometimes that is not the time to try to be mindful of it, because it does tend to just feed on itself. So that's a really great question. Thank you for that question. And it's time to stop. So thank you for your attention. And next time I'll talk more specifically about some of the other factors of the Eightfold Path around this wise and mindful speech. That won't be next week because I'm teaching a retreat next week, but the following week I'll talk about wise and mindful speech. Thank you.